Thanks for tuning in to Baxi's Musical Podcast today. If this is your first time, welcome. And if you've been here before, it's great to have you back. And if you like what you hear today, please subscribe to it, like it, share it with everyone you know, even complete strangers like new stuff from time to time. And if you can leave a big fat review, that would be amazing. Also, check out Instagram, TikTok, and Facebook for regular updates on what's coming up next on future episodes. Today, we're brought to you by Metro Chrysler Dodge Jeep and Ram in Chicopee. Visit Metro's state-of-the-art dealership right next to BJ's and Big Y on Memorial Drive. Or visit MetroJeep.com and drive home with your new Chrysler Dodge Jeep Ram today. Now, let's get started with my interview from Pearl Harbor. From Pearl Harbor and the Explosions on Baxi's Musical Podcast.
Baxi's Musical Podcast.
Resistance is useless.
In December of 1979, the San Francisco band Pearl Harbor and the Explosions released their self-titled debut album. The record was released on Warner Brothers Records and was produced by David Kahn, who would go on to produce albums for people like Paul McCartney and Tony Bennett, Stevie Nicks, New Order, and many more. The album was excellent and well-received by critics. In fact, the record even generated a minor new wave hit called Drivin', which I strongly suggest you look up and listen to. And while the album enjoyed some modest success thanks to a relentless schedule of touring, recording the next album would wind up not being so simple. Because while lead singer Pearl Harbor wanted to go in one direction, her band wanted to go somewhere else, the result of which caused the Explosions to break up due to a number of musical differences. But here's where things start to get interesting. Following the breakup of the Explosion, Pearl relocated to London in 1980 with her then-boyfriend Cosmo Vinyl. Cosmo had been an associate and a one-time manager of The Clash. Pearl was looking to form another band and record what would become her first solo album. But rather than record another album of potential new wave hits, Pearl decided she wanted to release a rockabilly record that held shades of British pub rock instead. The name of that record was Don't Follow Me, I'm Lost Too. And the backup band for that record included Paul Simonon, Mick Jones, and Topper Heaton of The Clash. The band also included the late Wilco Johnson from Dr. Feelgood, plus members of Ian Dury and the Blockheads, and from Graham Parker's backup band, The Rumour. And while that album was also great, Warner Brothers sided with the Explosions, and as a result, they did very little to support it, even though Pearl would regularly perform on stage with The Clash, performing her single from the album, Fujiyama Mama. The album, unfortunately, faded into obscurity and fell out of print. Soon, Pearl would begin dating Paul Simonon, and in 1982, the two of them would get married and stay together for the next 7 years. And a number of solo albums would then follow, including Pearl's Galore in 1983, and 1985, Here Comes Trouble, in which she recorded with East Bay Ray from the Dead Kennedys. In 2019, the first album with the Explosions was reissued. Some of her others were too, but that elusive solo record stayed put. That was until this year, where Liberation Hall announced that Don't Follow Me would be released this month. The record is a blast, and Pearl, with their all-star band of punk and pub rock legends, sound amazing. What's even more amazing is the story behind this record has never really been told until now. This is my long overdue interview with Pearl Harbor on Baxi's Musical Podcast.
Yeah, hi.
How you doing?
I'm okay. I'm here with you, so I must be okay.
Well, let's not get ahead of ourselves, Pearl. We haven't started talking yet.
Okay.
It's great to have you. I have to tell you, I've been listening to the record. Don't Follow Me. I'm Lost Too for like the last couple of weeks, and it's such a remarkable 180 from that first record. And the story behind it, I think, is so incredible. And the fact that Liberation Hall is releasing it is even more amazing. I mean, this is an album recorded 44 years ago. Tell me how you got the chance to get it back into circulation.
Well, I'm very, very thankful that they contacted me. Last year and the year before, different independent record companies have been asking me if they can re-release, you know, my old records. And so the first one that was done was my first Pearl Harbor and the Explosions. And I think, I can't remember, I think it was Blixa Sounds or something redid that. And then I think they all sort of saw that they were doing okay or something. And so Liberation Hall Records just contacted me and said, we want to re-release this. And I was very thankful because Warner Brothers didn't like this record at all. They loved Pearl Harbor and the Explosions, and they sunk a lot of money into us. So when I quit the band and said, I'm moving to London and I want to do rock and roll, they were really, really upset. And so when I handed them Don't Follow Me, I'm Lost Too, they were like, what is this? Because, you know, they were saying no hits. Production is terrible. You know, I'll admit the production isn't great. It's only rock and roll, isn't it? So you know, it's I just consider myself very lucky that it's being re-released, because hardly anybody got the opportunity to buy it or hear it.
So funny, because I remember hearing, you know, Drivin' from the first album, you know, which came out in 79. I even remember playing it in college radio and thinking, this is just a great record. It's just a great, solid new wave record. And you know, and clearly, I mean, you guys were, you know, working that record very, very hard, you know, touring constantly.
Yes.
And then, but then it comes time to start thinking about that second record. And it sounded like there was a division even in within the band about what direction you wanted to go. I mean, clearly you wanted to go in a more rock and roll, rockabilly direction. Yes. And I think they probably wanted to stay, you know, in that formula that was created in the first record. Tell me about that, what happened, you know, leading up to the split of that band.
Well, the first thing is that John and Hillary Haynes, bass player and drummer, are brothers. And the three of us were in a band called Leela and the Snakes together. And this was in 77 and 78. And then I think it was 78, we decided to leave the band and form our own band because we were playing Leela Jane's music, and we wanted to try writing our own music. We were all very young, early 20s. I had never fronted a band before. I hadn't really written, you know, any songs before. I'd written some lyrics, but I was, you know, we were all pretty green. And so when we first started rehearsing, John and Hillary got their friend Peter to play guitar. So the three of them, it was these three guys who were really tight, and they all liked the same kind of music. Now, had I known then what I know now, I wouldn't have joined a band with people that like to play music that I don't like.
Right.
But I liked them personally, so I kept thinking things were going to get better. So I would arrive at rehearsal, and they would be jamming their jazz fusion stuff, or whatever you call it, their new wave fusion. And I would be saying things like, I don't like this, and I can't, you know, write lyrics to this. And, you know, and they were all like, too bad. It was kind of three against one.
Yeah.
And so I just sort of said, all right. So immediately in rehearsal, things started going sour because of that. And Drivin is my favorite song, and I think it's the best song on the record. And I do like that song because it's catchy and danceable and all that junk. You know, as far as the rest of the album, it just wasn't my cup of tea. And Peter wrote a lot of the lyrics aside from me, and his lyrics are not words that I would sing or say. You know, they're not the way that I speak.
Sure.
And so I just got disgruntled about everything. And I loved performing live, and I loved performing. I didn't mind performing all those songs, even though I didn't like them, because I could be a ham and dance around and just do my own thing. But then, yes, towards the end of the tour, and we were talking about, you know, the second album, and they were saying, well, we want to go further into the fusion thing. And I said, I'm out of here. And I had met Cosmo Vinyl, who worked with Ian Dury and The Clash, and we dated, and he told me that I really should move to London, because London is where, you know, everybody likes 3-minute songs, everybody likes things raw, rockabilly, old-fashioned rock and roll, you know. So I did that. As soon as the tour was over, I moved to London.
when I think back to, you know, the early 80s where this is happening, you know, mm-hmm. rockabilly was kind of making a comeback, you know, not just in England, but it was even kind of making a small comeback here in the States. I mean, you look at the, you know, the Stray Cats and the Cramps, the
Polecats.
This was before
all of those bands.
Yeah, but clearly there was interest in that music that was probably germinating a little bit. I mean,
yes.
even if you look at like Joe Strummer's 101ers, there's a lot of rockabilly yes. played in that band too. And it just seemed to me that this was maybe forecasting maybe a little early, but you were not that so far removed from, you know, that genre being, you know, kind of, you know, worked on. It wasn't the craziest idea to start thinking in terms of rockabilly back then.
Well, I think number one, when I first started, you know, working with the Explosions, I went to my favorite record store in Mill Valley, which is up north, a record store called Village Music. It's like the best record store in the whole world. Unbelievable. Anyways, I said to the owner, play me your favorite rock and roll female singers, you know, from the 50s and 60s, because, you know, I'm starting a new band and I just don't know exactly what I'm doing and I want to be influenced by somebody. And so the first record he played me was Fujiyama Mama by Wanda Jackson. And that was it. Yeah. He didn't have to play me anymore. I liked it better than Brenda Lee. I like it better than Janis Martin. That was it. And the funny thing is, I hope it sounds okay for me to say, I naturally sing like her anyways. We have the same tone. Mm-hmm. We sing the same key. This was very easy for me to not copy her, but, you know, be very influenced by her singing. So Fujiyama Mama, and then, of course, Fujiyama Mama is rockabilly. And so, you know, I said, I want to sing like that. I want music like that. That's me. I want that, you know. And so then I brought it to the Explosions and they were like, hell no.
Yeah.
And so then I just put it in my back pocket. And so as soon as I moved to London, I said, this is what I want to do. And everyone in London knew Wanda Jackson. And yet no one in America did. And so that was interesting too. And then as soon as I got there, I went to all the record stalls at the flea markets because they had big stalls that were all rockabilly music. And it was so much fun. And so I just picked out all the songs that had funny and weird titles, you know, like Filipino Baby. I just grabbed that one because I'm half Filipino.
Right.
And all these things just worked and just came together because of that.
It's so funny. You know, there are so many examples of how people in Great Britain knew more about American music than Americans
did. They know their history.
They really did. I mean, everything from blues to, you know, certain
yes.
you know, gospel acts. I mean, it really is pretty
Absolutely.
Remarkable.
Yeah. It is remarkable. And I was impressed and I was really, my mind was blown. They knew everything, like you said, from the blues to gospel, to old soul, rockabilly, rock and roll, everything. They're amazing, those Brits.
One of the things that is, you know, pretty important or significant about this record is you had 3/4 of the Clash as your backup band, Topperhead and Mick Jones and your future husband, Paul Simonon. I think anybody would have just thrown themselves in front of a bus to have that opportunity to play with those guys at that moment.
And I was so lucky.
So how did that happen for you? I mean, how did you even meet them?
Cosmo, because Cosmo Vinyl, he was the personal manager of the Clash and Ian Dury and the Blockheads. So in 1977, Ian Dury and the Blockheads came to the United States for the first time and did their one and only U.S. tour. And they were rehearsing in the same rehearsal studio that I was in. So I was in the lobby, you know, talking to somebody, and Cosmo walks in. He's got purple hair and a purple plaid or tartan suit. And he comes up to me and says, "You're the second most beautiful girl I've seen today." And I was like, "Oh, brother, you know, who are you? You know, what a creep." And then he goes, "How would you like to see the greatest rock and roll band in the world?" And I'm like, oh yeah, who's that? And he goes, "Ever heard of Ian Dury and the Blockheads?" And I went, whoa. I said, yes. I said, oh my God, you're with Ian Jury and the Blockheads. And the reason I knew about Ian Jury was because our band had supported Elvis Costello on his first tour, but we didn't tour with him. We just played a whole bunch of dates in San Francisco with Elvis Costello. And so we hung out with their band a lot, and they were telling us what was going on musically in Britain. So I had the Sex Pistols album already, so I was sort of aware that punk was happening and all that, but I didn't really know that much about it. But he told me all about Stiff Records, and that sounded more like my cup of tea. So I did. I went and bought, you know, all the Stiff Records. And so when I met Cosmo and heard of Ian, I already knew Ian's songs, and I was just crazy about them. So I did. I went in and I saw some of their rehearsal, and it was fantastic. I mean, I was just the happiest gal in town. I was just musically, you know, on cloud nine. And then Cosmo liked me, so he started asking me, let's hang out, let's go do this, let's go do that. So we did. And then I went with Cosmo on some of Ian Jury's tour. I went with them to New York, you know, and I had a lot of fun. And then he said, I also work with The Clash. And I said, oh, I like them too. So then Joe and Mick came to work with Sandy Pearlman on Give Them Enough Rope. So that was in San Francisco. And so the two of them were in San Francisco, you know, working on that record. And so Cosmo was back in town for that. And he introduced me to Joe and Mick. And so I hung around with them a lot. We all had a lot of fun. And so then when The Clash came to tour, our band was a support act for a couple of things. And then I joined them as, you know, a fan and went, you know, on all the tours and just had a blast. I mean, I had more fun than anybody could ever imagine. So then that's when Cosmo said, you should move to London. And as soon as I moved to London, he said, look, I talked to The Clash and the Blockheads, and they all said that they would make a record with you. And what could I say?
Yeah, how can you say no to that?
Happy.
Yeah, there's some great video on YouTube of you playing with The Clash. You know, you're playing Fujiyama Mama, and it's much fun to watch you sing. I mean, the idea of just being on the stage with The Clash. I mean,
I know.
That has to be just an amazing memory. I mean, I realize you were in a relationship with Paul, and that's
it didn't matter.
It wouldn't have mattered. It's like what an experience.
Yeah, I mean, that's why, you know, when I did move to London and Paul played on my album, and then after we finished the album, Paul asked me out on a date, but he didn't you know, flirt with me or anything like that when we were making the record, because we were all, well, I guess you could say we were all professional, even though we were all drinking Guinness and smoking pot, but that doesn't matter. But we all had a lot of fun making the record, and it only took about 3 weeks, which in those days was, and that includes mixing.
Yeah.
You know, so we did everything really quick because all of them, especially Wilco Johnson was in Dr. Feelgood, and he's the best rhythm guitar player in the whole world. And so all these people really like 3 minute, no nonsense rock and roll. So that's what we set out to do. And then that's what we did. And we had so much fun. I can't tell you. And I keep saying this, but I'm very thankful and very lucky.
I wanted to ask you about Wilco Johnson. I know he just died last year, and he was such a great and unique guitar player. There's no one that played like him. But then you brought up Ian Dury, and I'm glad you did, because I think that's like one artist that Americans just have never really understood or embraced. But, you know, if you spend the time to really get into his music and you understand the history of pub rock and everything, you realize, I mean, this guy was just one of maybe the greatest lyricists, I think, in the last 100 years. I mean, just great. Just great.
I agree. And I was so lucky that Ian liked me, because he was a real gruff character and everyone was afraid of him, including Johnny Rotten, and all, you know, people would just, you know, back away from him because he did growl, and he would hit you with one of his caliper sticks, you know, his brace sticks, if he didn't like you. But he did like me. And so I think he thought I was a funny American girl. And I don't think most of those guys had met many American girls. And since I knew my musical history and I'm a record collector, he, you know, had respect for me. And so he gave me a thesaurus. He gave me a rhyming dictionary. He taught me how to use them. He taught me how to speak with the British press, because he said, they're going to try to bury you. They're going to make fun of you. They're going to tell lies about you. But if you're on top of it, you tell the lies, not them. You make up good stories. You entertain them. You're in control, not them. And so he taught me a lot, and I was really lucky. And I also sang on stage with them. You know, Ian invited me a couple of times. So that was, you know, also heavenly.
You guys record the record, and you're doing this at some level of risk. I mean, you walked away from another band that was on its way to being, you know, very successful. I mean,
yeah.
And you pour your heart into it, and then you present it to the record company. And like you said, they just didn't get it. And that happens more often than not. Walk me through that a little bit. I mean, you know, they tell you they don't like it. What happened next after that?
Well, I hand them the finished product. The head of publicity was this wonderful woman named Moira Bellis, and she loved it. She was a really cool woman, and but she was the only one who liked it. And the Americans especially hated it. The Brits liked it more than the Americans, because they were more familiar with that kind of music, and it wasn't a mystery to them. They didn't scratch their head and go, "What is this?" But the Americans did. They said, "No hits. You know, what is all this music? This has nothing to do with anything that's on the radio. We can't get you any, you know, radio play with this. We don't like it. And by the way, who's playing on the record?" So I told them everybody, but then they said, "Well, why didn't you credit anybody on the record?" So I don't know if you've seen the original, Don't Follow Me, I'm Lost Too, but I didn't do any credits. I didn't mention that the Clash and the Blockheads were the musicians and Wilco Johnson. And the reason why I did that was I was kind of being all punk rock about it. Cosmo and I talked about it, and we said that the British press were going to say, the only reason why anybody is listening to this record or anybody cares, and nobody cares about you, is that they, you know, wanted to hear what the Clash and the Blockheads were up to. And so, and that actually was true. So he said, "Why don't you mess with everybody's heads and just don't put anything on there?" And I mean, looking back on it today, I wish that I had put everybody's names on it, but I didn't. And so Warner Brothers really got upset about that. They said, "Look, we don't like this music. You won't credit the Clash and the Blockheads. We don't have anything to go on to sell this record. Goodbye." So that's what happened. They threw me off the label.
It's what's pretty interesting, though, is, okay, so they drop you, but then you get immediate interest from Epic, then Island. I mean, it's not like the music industry didn't understand who you were or what you were trying to do. I mean, they quickly swept you up, and within 2 years, you record a couple albums for both of those companies. Those are big.
Yes.
Those are big labels. I mean, big, important labels.
I know, I was lucky and I was happy, and I was really happy because they liked me. I mean, I have to be honest and say that Epic Sony was for Japan only, and the Japanese loved me because I sang with the Clash. Now, I'm not going to pretend they love me because they think I'm the coolest chick in town. They love me because I was with the Clash. And so everyone in Japan at that time used to call me Mrs. Clash. And it was okay with me. I didn't care. You know, I've been called worse things. And I was really thankful that the Epic Sony signed me right away. And they just wanted to work with me because I was Mrs. Clash. And so that did work out. Then I showed Island Records the Japanese recording and said, "This is for Japan only. Why don't you guys pick this up and do a worldwide release?" And they said, okay. And so Island Records, you know, took a few songs off of Pearls Galore, the Japanese version, and said, we don't really like these songs. Why don't you write a few more to replace these ones? So it's mostly the same record, but there are a few different songs on
it. Yeah. We've kind of touched briefly on your marriage to Paul Simonon from the Clash. I mean, obviously that's probably a very good reason why they're calling you Mrs. Clash. Tell me about that. I mean, you know, I mean, obviously it didn't last forever, but you know, but still, I mean, it's Paul Simonon from the Clash. I suppose when you're married to him, the sheen of the Clash kind of falls away a little bit. But tell me about that relationship with him.
Well, we did get along really well in the recording studio, and so when we first started dating, we would go to art museums because Paul is a painter and he's a very good artist, and
really
he
good.
Loves going to museums, and I like going to museums. So, you know, we first became sort of like very friendly and close because of art and music. And then we started going out and everything got serious and all that stuff. And so we started living together right away. And like I said, I went to all the Clash shows and, you know, we just got closer and closer and closer because of all that. You know, when you're on tour, everything is so... You know, it's crazy. It's exciting. A lot of emotions going through, you know, everybody's heads. You know, you're on stage, you know, regarding the Clash, they're on stage, you know, with a, you know, thousands of people screaming for them. And then you go back to your hotel room and you go back alone and everything's quiet and weird. So although with the Clash, it kind of wasn't like that. Joe used to take all the fans and let them come into his hotel room and they'd all have a jam session and blah, blah, blah. But yeah, so Paul and I got closer and closer. And then in 1982, we decided to get married because since I am American, I had a work permit so I could stay over there. But, you know, it wasn't that easy to be an American living over there.
Sure.
So, you know, we both, you know, said, and Paul very kindly, you know, said, you know, let's just get married. And so I said, oh, okay. And so, and I, you know, geez, I hate to sound like a cornball, but gee, I loved him so much that, you know, I wanted to stay with him forever. And we had a wonderful relationship. We had so much fun. I toured with the Clash and for years, you know, during all that time, you know, played on stage with Paul. We liked the same music. We liked the same clothes. We liked the same cars, the same motorcycles. We liked all the same stuff. So we got along really well and we were always together. Then the Clash broke up and Paul, you know, was in a space where he was a bit mixed up, you know, because his whole sort of life was changing now and he wasn't sure what he wanted to do. So Paul and I and my guitar player, the rockabilly guy, Nigel from Whirlwind, we started a band and we were working together. And then Bernie Rhodes, who's the Clash's manager, came over to see Paul and he was like, you know, what you up to, Paul? And Paul said, oh, well, Pearl and Nigel and I, you know, are starting a band and we, have written these songs. And then Bernie says right away, you and Pearl, he said, what do you guys think you are, Paul and Linda McCartney? And I just said, F you, Bernie, get the F out of our house, you know. And then he says to Paul, if I were you, why don't you and Nigel go to the United States, buy Harley Davidson's, go traveling around, write a bunch of songs and have some fun and get the hell out of Britain. And so Paul said, okay. So Paul and Nigel left me and there goes my guitar player. There goes my husband. And they did what Bernie said. And that was kind of the beginning of the end because I couldn't believe that that had happened to me, first of all. And second of all, and then when Paul was in the States, you know, he was, you know, he and Nigel were, you know, two bad boys on their motorcycles, you know, finding gals everywhere.
Yeah.
And so it was very difficult, you know, for Paul to want to go back to London and be married to me and, you know, just be this normal guy after doing all that. So after a while, I think it was in 88. Yeah, he said, you know, he wanted to call it a day. So what could I do? I was sad because I loved him so much. I wanted to stay together forever. But, you know, in rock and roll, nothing's forever, it seems, you know.
One of the things I want to ask you about is kind of, you know, switching gears here for a minute. In doing this podcast for the last couple of years, I've had a chance to interview Fee Wabel twice from the Tubes.
Oh yeah, I know Fee.
Yeah, and we talked at length about those early shows in San Francisco, and you know the more he talked about how, I mean, it's a circus, is what
it
those
was
guys.
A circus.
It really was, and you were a part of that. And I want to ask you a little bit about that because you know it just sounds like it's something that has never ever been replicated by anyone in a live setting before, to have as many as 50, 60 people on stage doing
a
million different things.
That's right. So I, when I moved to San Francisco from Germany in 1973, I was 17 years old. I'd never been to San Francisco. So I just immediately went to, and I was looking to be in a band. That was my goal. And so I went and saw all these bands, and a friend of mine worked for Bill Graham. So I got to see loads of music because Bill Graham owned most of the music venues in San Francisco, especially all the big ones like Winterland, the Fillmore, all that stuff. So I saw the Tubes, and when I saw the Tubes, that was it. I said, I want to be in that band because anything I could think of that I wanted to do, you know, roller skate, tap dance, anything that I knew how to do that was weird, I could do in that band. Plus, I just thought it was the best show I'd ever seen, and it was. Oh, you never saw them, did you?
I never saw them back then. I saw them probably at the end of the run, in the mid to late 80s. But you did.
Oh,
I
no.
Didn't, yeah. So it wasn't really the same. So
right. So they had a talent contest in 1976. And I won their talent contest by being a tap dancing boxer. So I made up this, you know, outfit and put a bandage on my eye and made a cape with pearl and glitter on the back. And I did shadow boxing to Phil Manzanera's Diamond Head music because I knew that the Tubes loved Roxy music. So I was no fool. I picked a song that I thought they would like. And then I wasn't a very good tap dancer, but it didn't matter. You know, I was just bouncing around, you know, shadow boxing. And so anyways, I won the contest, and the prize was that I got to dance with them for 3 weeks at Bimbo's. And Bimbo's was this really cool club. And so after the 3 weeks was up, they said, oh, we really like you. You know, do you want to do more shows with us? And I said, yes. So I did a lot of shows in California, but I never got to tour outside of California with them. But I roller skated, hula hoop, tap danced, sang background vocals, did percussion, you know, did cartwheels and flips. I mean, I just had a ball.
Every time I hear about those shows, it just sounds like I can't even imagine being in the crowd and getting every penny's worth of that show. Amazing.
Yeah. It was amazing. And the show, and I'm not saying it because I was in it, I'm telling you, that show was fantastic. They had so many talented people.
You know, Liberation Hall has done such a remarkable job with any number of projects that they've been involved with. And in many ways, you know, kind of righting wrongs and, you know, reintroducing the world to, you know, some great records and amazing live performances. And I'm very happy that they have been able to bring this record back. Don't Follow Me, I'm Lost Too. I think it's a great record and historically really significant. I mean, there's so much going on with you and the guys who are playing with you. I mean, it really is something remarkable. I know you're proud of it. And I know they're proud of it. And so, you know, congratulations for it coming back.
Oh, thank you so much. I agree that I'm a very lucky person to have this happen to me, and I'm so very thankful. I'm glad you like the record. And does everyone call you Michael or Mike or Baxi?
I'll answer to anything.
Hey you.
I'll answer to that too.
At any rate, I am so happy that they re-released this record because of all the records I made in my life, which is just 5 albums, but I like this record the best.
Yeah. Pearl, it's been a pleasure to talk to you. I wish you all the best of luck and good health and everything else.
Thank you so much, and you take care, and good luck to you and all what you do.
Thank you, Pearl. Appreciate it. Take care now.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Right. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. The name of Pearl's new album is Don't Follow Me. I'm Lost Too on Liberation Hall Records. Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed it. If you did, subscribe to it, like it, review it, share it with everyone you know, and make sure you follow us on Instagram, TikTok, and Facebook. You can email me at bax@rock102.com. I'd love to know what you think. And thanks to Metro Chrysler Dodge Jeep Ram of Chicopee, and thank you for listening to Baxi's Musical Podcast.